Tuesday, April 25th, was a full, busy day in the White House. With my coffee, I watched part of Chancellor Adenauer's funeral on TV via satellite, hoping I would glimpse Lyndon in the great old cathedral, but I saw only the grandeur and the chanting. And then I scurried about, getting ready for our annual meeting of the Committee for the Preservation of the White House, one of the most important things I'm associated with here in this house. We were together at 10 o'clock in the Yellow Oval Room. Alice Brown had spent the night with me before. I went over my notes and the agenda, briefing myself on what I wanted to report on. Made a quick trip to the Queen's room, and we got the carpenter to climb up on a stepladder, hoisting above him the pasteboard mock-up of the chandelier, a Waterford glass that Ovida Culp Hobby is thinking of giving to the White House. She has been our guest in the Queen's room, and I would particularly like it to be here. That is, and only, if it's a real beautiful addition to the room. Yep. Passes the test of Mr. DuPont and the discerning eye of our critical visitors. I do not want to accept gifts for the White House and then store them in that vast, musty room out at the airport along with Lucy Rutherford Hayes' huge portrait and somebody's wheelchair. Yep. It may have been Wilson's and many, many dressers and beds. We gathered at 10 o'clock. George Hartsog, chairman, and John Walker, and Bill Walton, and Mr. West, and Jim Ketchum, and Jim Fosberg, down from New York. He and his wife had spent a couple of hours the afternoon before going through the house, as had Mr. Henry DuPont, who to me is the final authority on our furnishings, and Alice Brown, and Liz, to gather a story for the press. We spent about 2 hours. We only do this once a year, and it's most serious and dedicated business. I welcome them over coffee and hot rolls, and then George Hartsog took over, reporting on the visitor services, a trial of the visitor orientation tape, along the fence where sometimes in spring the big crowds wait for 2 hours to get in, and the summer personnel, the new fence on the west side, the sprinklers on the lawn, and Mr. Ketchum talked about the new exhibit cases. He's working on one of Christmases in the White House, and another of White House dinners, with menus through the years. And I reported on the new dining room curtains and the chair upholstery. The fabric for the curtains is being especially woven for us from a design that had been used in 18th century Georgian houses in England. And there will be new ones in the Great Hall and up the stairway. Altogether, they'll cost about $37,000, and we hope to have them ready in the early summer. And Mr. West reported on other household matters, the blue room rug reproduction, and the big problem of the East Room mantels and baseboards. They're marble, but dull red, ugly. So we've painted them, a sort of an off-white camouflage that comes off and has to be repainted so often, almost every 2 weeks it seems, that it is a real household chore. Could we get the marble industry to give us 4 new ones, or could we buy them? Well, we could try. Every time anything came up, Mr. Hartsog asked if anyone would like to put it in the form of a motion, and he got things moving. I really felt we were accomplishing something. And then John Walker gave us a cheerful report from the White House Historical Association. Last year, they had allotted $50,000 for the White House, and our expected $37,000 expenditure would not entirely deplete that, and they would have another $50,000 for us for the coming year. So we can breathe easy. We can even afford to look for some new art object. Best of all, he told us that the Living White House had sold over 100,000 copies since November the 28th, and the White House guidebook is in its 7th edition. Bill Benton, who is absent today in Europe, had arranged to get direct mail advertising on the White House Historical Association publications sent out to all the list who take the Encyclopedia Britannica. I believe it's some 800,000 people, so that should result in some more sales. Jim Ketchum passed out a list of all our important acquisitions since our last meeting a year ago, most prominently the Aikens, and a tea service given to the Tafts on their 25th wedding anniversary in the White House, and the FDR portrait by Madame Shumatov. And he told us about the publication of the White House Library catalog, those 300 that I had autographed, and then a list of the books and articles and films concerning the White House which have been released in the past year. The loveliest of which, I think, is on the White House grounds, especially the commemorative trees with the most exquisite photography in vogue. And then I talked about the desired acquisitions, Most prominent on the list, a portrait of Adams and of Madison. And I told him that we were nearer to acquiring one of Madison, though nothing was promised. And I proudly showed them the provenance on it, which John Walker had gotten together for me. And then Jim Fosberg discussed the other paintings we might want to acquire. It all depends on what direction we want to go in. I felt, and the others agreed, that it should be top American artists, and that we could relax the criteria of having been dead 50 years and bring it down a little closer. We agreed that if the artists were dead or had stopped painting for 20 years, that would be enough settling into the past. I put forward John Singleton Copley and George Calum Bingham as two we most wanted, perhaps an Eastman Johnson. And then I told them about the offer to start a collection of presidential letters and first lady letters. We all decided that the criteria would be whether the letters shed a special light on their years here in the White House or on their characters, and that in a limited way this would be a very nice collection to use in our display cases or perhaps framed in the walls of certain rooms. And I told them about the offer of the Whitridge. It's from C.R. Smith, and it shows a scene on the River Platte, and I'm all for showing this great United States west of the Mississippi. And then, very quietly, I told Mr. DuPont that I would like for him to stay a minute longer and look at a picture of a chandelier and the place I proposed to hang it in, if he thought it was good. We asked Jim Fosberg to get together a list of American painters that he would like to see us acquire, that we would work toward only a very good example of each. And if he could get the list together in a few weeks, maybe we would have a meeting, or at least a few of us would meet sometime this fall and start on trying to pursue an acquisition or two. The meeting proceeded with lively interest, I thought, and some accomplishment. I feel good about it. I love it. My respect for this great old house grows every day, and I want to leave it a little richer than I found it. It was nearly 12 when we finished, and I said goodbye all around, and then took Mr. DuPont to the Queen's room. It took him only a few minutes of study of the picture of the chandelier and the proportions of the room, and the mock-up itself, though we didn't call the carpenter back, but Teeter from the top of the stepladder. Then I had a little time to say goodbye to Alice. What a good visit we'd had, especially the night before. And dress for the Senate ladies and leave for the White House to be met at the entrance to the old Senate office building by Mrs. Pell and Mrs. Case, the chairman and co-chairman of the luncheon this year, and Muriel. I wore my yellow Ben Zuckerman. The day was chill, though the flowers were beautiful. The lilac at the gate welcomes me every time I come in these days. And the circle around the fountain is a great blaze of color. Yellow emperors, red emperors, some I don't know that are a mixture of orange and yellow, white trumpeters, and a border of white pansies, with the spray flying in between as the wind whips it. All over town, the tulips are glorious, and every visitor I have tells me about it. The luncheon was in the Senate caucus room, where the first one I'd attended in 49 was, I believe, well, decorated with palms, with round tables on which there were green and yellow floral tablecloths, I think a salute to beauty, and white flowers. No. It was a familiar, happy scene to me. All the cabinet wives lined up, with Muriel and me at the head, and the Senate ladies in their Red Cross uniforms filed past with many an embrace and laughter and memories of the things we had done in the past. And then we went to our tables. I sat between Muriel and Wayla Pell, and Mrs. Case, the co-chairman, and Mrs. Mark Hatfield and Maureen Mansfield were at our table, and Luella Dirksen. It's the only time there's ever been a mother-daughter combination, she and her daughter, Mrs. Baker, from Tennessee, and Mrs. Eleanor Tidings, who is now Mrs. Ditson, and looks very young and happy. It was an absolutely delicious luncheon, beginning with crab au gratin, courtesy of the Maryland senators. I talked to Mrs. Percy about the wedding, and to Ethel Kennedy about the new baby. He's beautiful. But much of my thoughts were on the old-timers. Darling Mrs. Toby, who is still the boss of the working ladies. Henrietta Hill, very feeble now, with, I think it must be, Parkinson's disease. And quite the contrary, Lucy O'Connelly, who at a very advanced age is still beautiful and very feminine. But there's a dropping off in the old-timers, and for the first time I remember, Mrs. Henry Wallace did not come. At the end of the luncheon, there were the reports on the work, the number of bandages rolled, the sewing, the knitting, and a warm, sweet speech by Muriel for the presentation to me, a Vermeer picture frame, to be used sometime in June. For once, I was satisfied with my response. It's much easier to say something if you have something to say. And to these ladies, so many of whom I have known for 18 or more years, I do have something. Shared memories, a common role in our husbands' lives, and I feel they really like me. I left a little before 3. I'd made a date with Bob Knudsen to go on a picture-taking expedition, searching around Haynes Point for the prettiest blooming cherry trees. We got some rather good shots. I want to send some pictures to those generous people who've made gifts and inscribe them, "This is your tree," and by a melon fountain, which is white with Mary Lasker's azaleas. There, a colored woman came up to me in surprise and said, "Lady Bird Johnson?" And we shook hands and exclaimed. And she said her children always came home from school with some news about the beautification program and how they were putting out flowers around their school, or with a package of flower seed. In the late afternoon, I returned to the White House for a little rest before time to dress for the reception for Mr. Justice Black, celebrating the 30th anniversary of his appointment to the court. As soon as Lennon had decided to go to Adenauer's funeral, I had called the justice and said, much as Lennon would miss it, I thought we'd better go on with the reception, because many of the guests were coming from Alabama and far and near, and so I'd asked the Chief Justice to stand in as my host. A little before 6, I went down to the green room to greet Mr. Justice Black and Elizabeth and the Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren and their immediate family, and then in the blue room, we stood in line, the Chief Justice in the spot that would have been Lyndon's, and then me and Justice Black and the other ladies. And by they came, a roster of those who loved Hugo Black. 40. His family, his son, Hugo Black Jr. from Miami, his wife and little Hugo III, and his other son, Sterling, now a state senator from Los Alamos, New Mexico, and granddaughter Anne, a charmer. The Hollis Blacks, a nephew from Los Angeles. The Fawcetts, a niece from Alabama. JoJo, his daughter from New Jersey. The Aubrey Taylors, another niece from Sylacauga, Alabama, and all his fellow justices on the Supreme Court, and 40 of his law clerks, beginning with 1937. One of them, the dean of the law school at the University of Alabama now. Each of them he greeted by name in a very personal manner and usually kissed their wives, explaining to me that they were his family. They were former justices of the Supreme Court, including Arthur Goldberg, and widows of justices, and one son, Fred Benson, Jr., and a sprinkling of eminent jurists who are his special friends from around the country, both Alabama senators, Lister Hill and John Sparkman. And then that delightful, perfect Hugo Black touch, his messenger and his cook. I've never been to dinner at the justice's home, but what when dinner was over, with dignity and ceremony, he would escort us back to the kitchen. And we would tell Elizabeth how good the cornbread, or the turnip greens, or the dessert was, and I would be saying to myself, only with a southerner. I asked one of the staff to have a photographer standing by, and when the receiving line was over, we gathered all the Black clan together for numerous pictures. The immediate family, and then all the cousins, and then just the grandchildren, and everybody. There was a warm holiday spirit that this is a once-in-a-lifetime event. The spirit of celebrating, of completion, I loved it. It was one of my happiest parties in the White House. And then we went into the state dining room where everybody else was drinking and eating and talking all at once. But decades of things they had to talk about. This must have been a reunion for so many of them. Tom Corcoran and Ben Cohen were there, and Tom's daughter Margaret Josephine, who is the justice's last law clerk. I reminded Tom that it was at his own house to which I had gone for the celebration of a 25th anniversary of the justice's arrival in Washington. And that was a very long time ago indeed. And then the toast began. The vice president, so much in tune with the philosophy of this southern senator and justice, so warm of heart and quick of wit. Tonight, he was outdistanced because there was so much to say by those who had shared these years. One of the justice's law clerks announced a gift of a chair of law at his alma mater, the University of Alabama. I felt I saw Tom Corcoran's hand in this. And then another one, now the dean of the University Law School, accepted it for the school. And then the justice himself got up to respond. Never did I wish more that we'd had a tape recording. It was one of those times when you get caught up in a stream of listening and feeling, and you're thinking you're just living your life over and remembering events and people. He reminisced about the years he had spent here, and they go back far beyond 30, for he was a senator for something like 12 years, I believe. He talked about his feelings for his fellow senators and justices on the court, and the changes of the Roosevelt years, and the time when President Roosevelt called him down to the White House to announce that he was going to put him on the court, and all the changes since. There was a web of silence in the state dining room, and a communion between all the guests. I think it was probably a long speech, but we would all have liked more. And when it was over, Elizabeth invited the entire crowd out to her house to continue the party. I dare say a lot of them went, with the happy feeling of a hostess who thinks she's given a good and memorable evening to her guests, and who had most emphatically enjoyed it herself. I said good night to them all. Never were so many Alabamians joined under the roof since I've been here, and about 8:15 went upstairs, where Jake and Beryl Pickle were waiting for us. Linda Bird had come in. She'd been present for the first half of the party, had met everybody, had been scintillating, beautiful, and left a stream of compliments behind her. And then she had gone on to a reception at the Colombian Embassy, I believe, a part of her preparation for going down to see the ship Hope. I'd asked the kitchen to take up a big platter of sandwiches and cookies and coffee to the solarium, and the Pickles and Linda and I went up there and christened the new bridge table, eating sandwiches with one hand while we played bridge. It was just the right relaxing end for a day that had been busy and that I had tried to do my best in, because now I could really take off my shoes, not mind what I said, and relax in a good game. The Pickles left about 11:30, and I went to bed feeling that I couldn't have filled more full my days while Lyndon was gone with those things that I don't do when he is here.